Welcome to our paranormal afterlife.
This is an Our Paranormal Afterlife classic episode. I'm your host, Simon Bowne. So in these classic episodes, I find they're full of great information, and I thought it would be a good idea to share them again for listeners who may have missed them the first time around. So this is one of the episodes that stands out for me from the early days of the podcast, and this episode dates back to December 2018. It features a conversation with Shepherd Hoodwin, where we talk about channeling the Michael teachings.
Shepherd channels an entity called Michael. He's been channeling Michael since 1986. He also does intuitive readings, mediumship, past life regression, healing, counselling, and channeling coaching. He is the author of several books on the Michael teachings and spirituality. Hi, Shepherd. Thank you very much for giving us your time. You channel Michael, and could you tell us who is Michael?
Michael is the name given to a group of souls who work together as a soul family from what we call the causal plane. They first came to a small group of friends in Oakland, California in 1973 who were channeling at a Ouija board, and they began to bring through extraordinary information that explains how we as eternal souls set up our series of lifetimes as humans here on Earth. It explains so much about why we are the way we are and why others are different from us for very good reasons, and how we can stay more in the positive sides of our traits.
How is it that you came to be channeling Michael?
I had been working with inner guidance for many years. I had been in daily communication with my spirit guides. We all have spirit guides, and in most cases, our spirit guides are active in our lives even if we're not conscious of them. But I became conscious of them at an early age and began to hear their messages quite early on. And then in 1986, I was 31 at the time, a friend told me about the Michael teachings, and I was immediately fascinated by them and had decided that I was going to look for the first Michael book and read it, and that I was going to find a Michael channel so that I could ask a number of questions to. I was at my desk at work for Citibank in New York City, and it was quiet, and I thought, you know, I better write down my questions for Michael so when I find a channel, I will be prepared. And my pencil kept moving, and I got an answer. So I thought, well, that's interesting. One of the questions was for the friend who had told me about the teachings, so I sent it to her, and she said, oh, that's great. Ask him this now. And that's how I started channeling Michael over 32 years ago now.
And how does the channeling work now? Because that sounded like automatic writing in some way.
Yes, and that's the only time I've ever done automatic writing. Since then, I moved on to more conscious writing, where I was asking specific questions and I was listening for the answers word by word. And then someone else connected me with other Michael channels in Northern California, and they told me that, well, no one's using the Ouija board anymore, and we're all just doing it through speaking. So I started practicing with a tape recorder, doing it through speaking. And now I do both written and spoken channeling.
And when you are channeling, where are you? Do you just step aside completely?
I am a conscious channel. So I'm in the background, but I don't go away. And the benefit of that is that I get to hear what Michael is saying and learn from it also. In the past, it was more common for channels to go into a deep trance. For example, Edgar Cayce was known as the sleeping prophet. He would sleep and someone would write down what he said, but he didn't have any memory of it. So if he didn't read it afterward, he had no idea what was going on. I think in times past, it was useful for channels to be in deep trance because it was harder to make contact with the discarnate levels of being. And so being unconscious meant that you were going to be more out of the way. Now, bias could still slip in, even through a full trans channel, but at least the more obvious, blatant, conscious-level biases were put out of the way. Now it's easier to make that connection, and there are a lot of advantages to channeling consciously if people are willing to be scrupulous about putting their biases out of the way as much as possible.
When you're doing this, do you ever get involved in a conversation with Michael, or do you just tend to sit back and let him do all the talking?
I can do a conversation, particularly if I'm channeling for myself or I'm doing written channeling. I'll be the client's proxy, and I'll say, well, I'm sure they're going to ask this question, or could you clarify that, or what about that? And for my own benefit, I can certainly have a conversation back and forth. But when I'm doing a live Q&A session with a client over the phone or over Skype or in person, almost always I just stay out of the way and let the client have that conversation and ask whatever the client wants to ask. Sometimes I'll pipe in my mind and I'll say, well, what about this?
And how does it feel for you? Do you get some kind of, I don't know, weird feeling come over you? Just feel normal? And is the voice just in your mind?
No, I channel a great deal of healing energy. And so it's extremely visceral. It's, in fact, rather hard on my body, but it's kind of an amazing experience, too. I feel a lot of profound sensations. And if people are in the room with me when I'm channeling for them, they may see my face change. They may see lights around me. They may feel tingling in their body. So, no, I don't feel ordinary. But I should point out that every channel's experience is different. And most of the channels I know don't have this kind of intense visceral experience that I have. Part of my soul level agreement with Michael is to combine the intellectual information with transformational healing energy. And so it comes through me in that particular very intense way.
And has Michael ever said why he has chosen to communicate through you?
Most things that happen on the physical plane, including whether or not you channel, are by mutual agreement. As eternal souls in human bodies, the human part of us may not remember the agreements that we made in spirit before we incarnated or behind the scenes while we were physically asleep. But we do, in fact, agree to a lot of the things that happen in our lives. We choose our parents that way, and they choose us. And so those who channel usually have a mutual agreement with the entity that they're channeling. And if you don't and you really want to do it, you can make a new agreement on the fly. If you have the capability of channeling, which most people might to some degree, and the strong interest, you can usually arrange someone who's willing to work with you on that, because discarnate souls, people who are not in human physical bodies at the moment, welcome an opportunity to speak through a human being and be more actively involved with humanity.
So what does Michael say that we are basically as souls?
Michael teaches that each of us at the core of ourselves is what they call a spark of the Tao. The Tao is a Chinese word spelled T-A-O, and it means the ground of all being, the source, the undimensional aspect of things. And as this eternal spark of the Tao, we each decided that we wanted to have the adventure and growth opportunity of incarnating as human beings for a series of lifetimes. There are countless planets in the universes that have life forms that are capable of self-aware, intelligent life. We happen to choose the human form here on Earth. There is another life form on Earth that is capable of self-aware intellectual function, and that is the dolphins and whales, the cetaceans. So obviously, we chose to be human, and we set up our series of lifetimes by gathering together with other souls who are interested in coming here and joining into soul families, which we call in the Michael teachings entities. And we plan where we're going to first incarnate and what sorts of experiences we're going to be looking for as a group. And then we split up and we start incarnating and having experiences.
And as Michael talked about the first incarnations, and I'm thinking about in relation to the evolution of man, was there a point where the soul started to incarnate when the body was in the right condition?
Humans have been incarnating as sentient souls on Earth for a long time. It varies from individual to individual when they started. There are souls here who have been around here for hundreds of thousands of years, and there are souls whose first lifetime was, say, 6,000 years ago. It's just a matter of how you want to do things. The physical plane, in fact, the whole universe is sort of like the old song Alice's Restaurant, where you can get anything you want. You can do whatever you want to do. You can do the physical plane in whatever way interests you. So you can have a few lifetimes and be done with it, and then focus your time on the astral plane, which is the second plane of creation. Or you can want to stick around for a really long time and have a lot of lifetimes, or you can skip whole epochs of time and then come back when it interests you again. So there are no hard and fast rules about what you can and cannot do. And so some souls just find it very interesting and they want to be in a lot of different cultures, speak a lot of different languages, be both male and female, be rich and poor. And some choose a more limited color palette for their experiences, but it's all valid. It's rather like going to a university, and some people will decide to get advanced degrees and take a lot of extra classes, and some people will just do the minimum that they need in order to graduate. But there's no good or bad about that. It's just you get to do what interests you.
With karma, is there a possibility that souls can kind of get stuck on Earth where they have to keep having lives to clear up karma?
Yes, karma is one of the ways that we grow as souls. Karma is simply where you violate another person's rights and you take something from them, some energy from them that does not belong to you, and that means that it will then need to be paid back. So these can be, for example, you murder someone, you took their life from them, then you owe them a life. And that will be paid back in one of two ways. They have the same but flip side experience in another lifetime where they kill you and then you're even. Or you agree that you will save their life in a future lifetime. So you've given them a life that they wouldn't have otherwise have had. We need to have experiences in order to grow. And no one will get through the physical plane without incurring some karma. Because when we start out in our first lifetime on a soul level, we're a blank slate. We may have experienced the same game in other life forms on other planets before this one, but the soul is new. Just like in each individual lifetime, a newborn infant is new. There may be deeper levels that remember their past lives. And on the soul level, there's deeper levels where you remember other planets that you've been on. But there's a certain level where you're a blank slate. And so you're going to make mistakes. And in the soul's development, there are certain areas that are similar to the toddler. We call that the terrible twos, where maybe this sweet, docile baby, once he or she begins to walk, starts getting a little destructive, taking away toys from other children and hitting and not knowing any better. And so we all go through this and we all create some forms of karma. Some souls create a lot more karma than others. Some create a lot more than is necessary. And some do, as you say, get stuck in repetitive karmic patterns. So for example, let's say that I'm a pretty unconscious soul, and I think someone has wronged me when maybe the other person really didn't wrong me, and I kill that person. So I owe a karmic debt to that person. And then in the next lifetime, that soul kills me, and the karma could be over at that point, only I don't take responsibility for it. I don't say as a soul, oh, okay, I understand. I was paying back something I owed. I'm going to learn from this. I'm not going to do it again. But instead, some souls just don't look at their part in this karmic formation. And they say, that person just killed me, and I'm really angry, and I'm going to go kill that person again. And you harbor this resentment and desire to get even, so you create karma again with that person. And then it just goes on and on and on and on. That's a very simplified example. But even though our guides are on hand to advise us and say, look, hey, this is on you, you don't have to listen. And particularly souls who get heavily wounded early on may develop a chip on their shoulder where they are not really that well equipped to get themselves out of it, and they reject offers of help. And so they can get into this very repetitive, ugly karmic cycle. At certain point, most souls will wake up and say, okay, I'm done with this. This is getting old even for me. And I want to show me how, guides, show me how to get out of this. And so then you can start getting off the karmic wheel, at least to some degree, and start having your lessons on the physical plane in happier ways. And Michael calls this growing through joy versus growing through pain. The soul is here to grow. We're all students. We're all here because we saw the human form on planet Earth as a great way to grow, to have experiences that where we could polish our skills and where we could ultimately increase our capacity for unconditional love. And so every experience can help us grow. Every experience is valid, whether it's happy or unhappy. But when we become more conscious, we learn to choose the happier ways to grow. So, for example, we could grow a great deal through creative projects, through building a beautiful building or painting a painting or creating a symphony or creating happy families or pioneering new methods of farming that lead to more food being produced. There's all sorts of ways we can grow in more consciously, more conscious alignment with unconditional love. And so if we are on a spiritual path, if we are interested in awakening, we try to do it that way. But those who are still, you know, killing each other are also having lessons. And ultimately, they can learn from that. And at the point that they finally wake up, they may become great teachers of other people, because they've been in the trenches of doing horrible, really even evil things to other people. And then they woke up and they saw, you know what, I see what's going on here. And I can see how much unhappiness this is bringing me and others. They can teach other people who are still stuck in that in ways that some of us wouldn't have the authority to do.
Is it possible that there may be contracts between souls or agreements where before life, they say, okay, in this life, I'm going to cause you pain because that's what you need as a learning experience?
There can be agreements between souls for absolutely anything. And so, yes, there are sometimes agreements, as you described. But usually it's not quite so simple as that description implies. And so let's say I agree to be your wicked stepmother and to force you to take responsibility for your own growth and not rely on the love and nurturing of other people, because I'm not going to give it to you. That could be an agreement. But the person who is agreeing to be the wicked stepmother is probably not a very loving soul to begin with. Otherwise, they wouldn't be able to play that role. So it fits that soul's development, because that soul kind of has those tendencies to not be very nurturing in the first place. You would not likely find a saintly soul. I mean, by that I mean a soul who's done a lot of work on itself to be an excellent beacon of unconditional love. You're probably not going to find that kind of soul agreeing to be your abusive stepmother, because it's just not who that soul is. But let's say you know that that soul has some lack of development in compassion and so forth, and you might say, well, I need to learn how to love myself and not rely on mother's love. So you may team up with that soul and say, okay, all right, I know, you know, where you are in your soul development and where I am in mine. And our guides seem to think that it's a good fit and we could work together. But I have heard people say that, well, you know, people like Hitler and Stalin were really great souls giving us all these wonderful lessons, and they were sacrificing a lot in order to play that role up for humanity. I don't buy that idea. I think that if they were, you know, these great, wonderful, generous souls, then it would have shown up in the kinds of choices that they made. I think that they were damaged souls, but because there are a lot of damaged souls on Earth, then having them volunteer to represent all of them and act out this cruelty is a good fit for everybody's growth. It just is. It's not the only way we could be learning on the physical plane. We could be choosing to learn more consciously and more joyfully. But since a lot of people are already learning through all of these painful karmic experiences, some people do step in to represent the karma of a lot of other people.
Is it a situation where perhaps it kind of escalated or snowballed, and all this bad kind of karmic debt has built up over many years, and the human race, the souls here, are caught up in a never-ending cycle?
I would say that despite the appearance, it's getting better, not worse. I think more and more people are waking up. I think there's less and less karmic formation. But I do think a lot of the old stuff is coming to the surface so that people can look at it. Things that had been buried in the shadows are coming to the surface. So we see someone like Donald Trump in the United States, who is a very damaged and stunted soul, having a lot of power and doing a lot of damage. But then all the people that follow him are getting an opportunity to see a reflection of themselves. According to my channeling, about 2/3 of the people that follow Trump are so defended and cut off from their higher selves that they're not going to learn from this experience this time. But about 1/3 could learn from the experience. They could look at him and say, well, I voted for him because I thought this was going to happen, and now I'm starting to have second thoughts about it. Maybe I made a mistake. Maybe I can start to look at my own resentments and fears and prejudices and heal them, because I'm seeing a reflection of it outside of me in Donald Trump and his administration, and I don't like what I'm seeing. And so I think we are growing. I think we're actually coming out of a very dark, long period of human evolution. The yogis talk about these vast periods of time that have certain astrological traits. And they say that we're coming out of what they call the Kali Yuga, which is a period of great darkness. And we're just at the beginning of being able to come to a place of greater light. So all of this, all of these shadows, all of this hatred and prejudice has to come to the surface in order to be healed.
If we look at what the Germans did in the Second World War, that's sort of getting to a peak of the really bad things that are going to happen, and hopefully we're going to start to leave that behind us.
Yes, and all is choice. So everyone has free will, and every soul, every individual gets to choose, am I ready to leave this behind? Am I willing to look in the mirror? Am I willing to repudiate, for example, anti-Semitism? And so the horror of the Holocaust did result in many souls being shocked out of their anti-Semitism. But obviously, we still have pockets of anti-Semitism where souls have not chosen to leave it behind. So it everything is by choice, but I think in general we're moving forward.
Now, there are a lot of people, channels, that communicate with Michael. Is the information that comes through consistent through everybody?
It's fairly consistent. Yes, there are quite a number of Michael channels. There are maybe 30, 40 books out by different authors over the last 40 years on the Michael teachings. Generally, what I find is that when people come for their Michael chart, I channeled your Michael chart, and we'll be talking about that in depth shortly. When people go and get their Michael chart, it's usually the most correct the first time. If it comes through a channel that tends to be accurate with this sort of material and who are good at this, at doing Michael charts. And so if people go for very specific information to more than one source, it may not always agree. But in general, the teachings are similar, and the differences are simply because every instrument is different, every channel is different, their agreements are different, the skill levels are different. It's not a perfect process, but in general, there's a lot of alignment among the various channels in terms of the information they get, and some discrepancies.
Hello, Simon here. I conduct past life regression therapy sessions over Zoom, and these sessions can be very insightful and healing. If you go to my website, pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, you can book a free 20-minute consultation where we can discuss what it is you would like to achieve. You'll find the link to my website in the show notes.
Now, I believe Michael talks about different planes of existence. Could you give us a description of those, please?
We're obviously on the physical plane, and that's the first plane of existence. When we, as sparks of the Tao, decided to do planet Earth, we start by inhabiting the physical plane using human life forms. Now, we will have a certain number of lifetimes as humans on the physical plane. It could be as few as 37, as many as 1,500, but whatever we've chosen, we will have so many lifetimes and go through various stages of soul development, which in the Michael teachings are called soul ages. So we go through being an infant soul where we're getting used to the planet. You asked me earlier about the first lifetimes for souls, and maybe I can answer that here. The infant soul in its first lifetime is brand new, and usually it's set up so that those first lifetimes are easy. This correlates with the stories in the Bible about the Garden of Eden. Those first lifetimes are where the soul is just getting used to being in the human form, and usually they will incarnate into idyllic places, like maybe a beach in the South Pacific, where all they have to do is pick the fruit off the tree, and they have other souls that are taking care of them while they get used to things. And they can be quite beautiful in those first lifetimes where they're still very much in touch with the Tao. And they're quite radiant and sweet, but quite simple. Much in the same way that newborn infants have that radiance that comes from the fact that they are still partly in the spirit world. They haven't come all the way into the body yet. They haven't become earthbound yet. And so in those first lifetimes, you tend to incarnate with members of your soul family. So a lot of you may come in together, and that provides also some comfort, just like, you know, when you're born, obviously, or with your biological. And so the soul doesn't have too much to do in those first lifetimes except get used to the human body, learn how it works, learn how to talk and walk and be athletic and deal with the environment, and this is how you survive. And so the elders in the tribe will instruct you on, you know, which plants not to eat so that you don't die, and which animals to avoid, how to deal with wild animals, etc. Because if you can't survive, then you can't have the lessons of the physical plane. So that's what you focus on. And as you get more accustomed to the physical plane and you've learned how to survive, then you as a soul start becoming more interested in working within small-scale societal structures. And this is what we call the baby soul cycle. You're no longer an infant soul, you're a baby or toddler soul. And so you're learning about rules. So you will have small communities where there are certain rules to follow, whereas infant souls may have sex with everyone else without regard for who it is or who might be the father of the particular baby, because maybe they don't even understand that that's where babies come from. There start to become some rules in the baby soul cycle. So the infant souls are frequently hunter-gatherers, and the baby souls then start to form communities around agriculture. And there starts to be more limiting kinds of religion, because you're learning how to function with rules at that point. And this there tends to be then more of my community versus your community, and the soul, having lived in this idyllic Garden of Eden state for a while, starts to get a little antsy and may start to form karma with other souls. This is what I was talking about earlier relative to karma, where you get in the terrible twos and you say, no, this is my land. This is my land. And they fight over it. They form karma and they don't really know much better at that point. And so increasingly throughout the baby soul cycle, the souls start to build larger and larger cities, more and more complex societal structures. And then you move into the young soul cycle, where the individual is king. And the individual souls want to dominate others. They want to test themselves to see how much they can accomplish. And so they're very hardworking. They might try to accumulate money or rise to the top of the social structure. The average person on Earth right now is fifth level young, meaning that there are more young souls right now in charge of things than any other soul age. And we have a lot of territorialism as a result of that. But we also have, on the positive side, we have a lot of material comforts that we've never had before, because the young soul is motivated to work very hard to make things happen in the outer world. We are moving toward the mature soul cycle, which is the biggest change that can happen on any planet in terms of soul development. So we went from infant to baby to young, where the souls were increasingly more oriented in the outer world and more isolated from each other. It's sort of like in an individual lifetime, we move from being an infant where we're totally helpless to being a toddler where we're learning about the rules, and then we become a youngster where we can go out and play on our own, and we are more self-sufficient. We're riding our bike around the neighborhood, and we're less interested in our own family and meeting new friends and maybe getting into trouble and going to school and so forth. And then when adolescence hits, we suddenly have this whole new level of lessons that come to us as individual humans. We start to have hormones going through our body, and we get interested in sex and relationships, and our emotions are much less stable, and we're starting to explore the inner world, and we want to discover who we really are. So the adolescence of the soul is very much like the next soul age, which is called the mature soul cycle, where the soul, having already accomplished success in the outer world, becomes interested in emotions, relationships, and the inner world. And so we're moving toward that as a species, and certain countries already now have an average soul age of mature soul. For example, the United Kingdom is a mature soul. So you over across the pond are older in soul age than we are here in the United States, where we average sixth level young. And so in many of the EU countries where, for example, you have socialized medicine, the mature soul cycle is looking out for the community. And so it's natural for many of the European countries to be thinking about How can we take care of everybody's needs and make sure that everybody is heard? The United States isn't quite there yet, although we can see the signs of it coming. We can see it in the media. We can see it in our movies and music and such, the mature souls casting their influence on the younger souls, saying, hey, there's something here where we can start to take care of each other and love each other and relate to each other. And so the late level young souls are getting interested in this because they're moving in that direction. And the last soul age that we have on the physical plane is the old soul cycle. And old souls are looking at the world in terms of there's you and me, yes. We studied that in depth during the mature cycle, but there's also a context that we find ourselves in. And so the old soul gets interested in philosophical types of issues, like how do you and I fit together? And they start to become increasingly detached from the physical plane, less interested in work for its own sake, less interested in becoming successful for its own sake, and more interested in how do we all fit together? How can we blend with the cosmos? And then when the old soul cycle is finished, when the soul has gone through all the stages of development that we have on the physical plane, then it will do something that we call cycle off, which means being done with the physical plane. And we're full-time on the second plane, which is the astral plane. Now, the astral plane is not foreign to us at all. We spend a lot of time on the astral plane in between our lifetimes. And also, many of us visit the astral plane quite a bit when we're asleep at night in the dream state. But when we cycle off, we are full-time on the astral plane. We may work as spirit guides to others, and we are exploring more the emotional side of things on the astral plane. Whereas on the physical plane, we're exploring more the tangible side of things. So then we go through the astral plane. We reunite with our soul family, increasingly start working as a team with our soul family and move higher and higher through the astral plane. And then our whole soul family crosses over to the third plane, which is called the causal plane. And we start working together as a reuniting entity in a more intellectual way, where we're exploring the realm where thoughts are things. Now, Michael is a causal plane entity, so they teach from the causal plane, and their growth comes through teaching. Again, it's an intellectual plane, so they have given us this intellectual system that helps us understand life.
So is there three planes and that's all there is, or is there more?
There are seven planes total. There's a central plane, the fourth plane, which is the Akashic plane. And we don't actually have a cycle of experience on the Akashic plane, but we use it as a resource, sort of a library. And then things flip, and we have the three high planes, which are abstract. Physical, astral, and causal are concrete planes. They're where we're having experiences. And then the three high planes are the mental plane, the messianic plane, and the Buddhaic plane. The mental plane is the mirror image of the causal plane in that it's intellectual, but it has to do with abstract intellectual experience. The messianic is the flip side of the astral plane, where we have higher emotional experiences, abstract emotional experiences. And the Buddhaic plane, which is the highest of the seven planes, is the flip side of the physical plane, where we're having higher energetic experiences. And when we, as a soul family and in groups of soul families, which have increasingly reunited, pass through and complete the Buddhaic plane, then we are reabsorbed back into the Tao, and we are complete with one grand cycle. We have experienced a grand cycle centered around planet Earth, and we take everything that we learned back to the Tao as growth and knowledge. And then if we want to, we can do the whole thing all over again on another planet in a different life form.
I'd like to go into the chart now.
Could you tell us what a Michael chart is?
Over the decades, Michael has taught us a great deal about how we set up our lifetimes, and they've given us a whole system with categories. So, for example, they tell us that there are seven soul types. Most spiritual and religious people will agree that we are or have an eternal soul. But most of them do not explain that there are seven different types of souls. And knowing this explains so much about the differences among people. And so on your Michael chart, it lists the seven soul types, and you'll see a bullet point on your chart for the role that we call sage, which tells you what your role or soul type is. You'll also see a lot of other categories. You'll see the role or soul type of your twin soul. Most of us have a twin soul. You will see where you are, your precise location within your soul family, which is about 1,000 souls, and what those numbers mean in terms of different mathematical resonances that you have. The top half of your chart is your soul, and these are traits that are true of you in every lifetime as a human on planet Earth. The bottom half of the chart is called overleaves, and these are personality traits that overlay or lay on top of your eternal soul and can change in every lifetime. And so we profile you as a soul and as a person in this lifetime. In the overleaves, we show seven goals. And before you incarnated in this lifetime, you chose a goal called dominance. That's one of seven. You chose an attitude or way of looking at the world called skeptic. You chose a mode or a way of functioning, which is called caution. Again, one choice out of seven. You chose a center for this lifetime, which is where you're going to react from in this lifetime. And you've chosen to do it from your body in the physical center. Although you're a sage soul, and sages tend to be quite intellectual. You chose a chief obstacle, which is something that blocks your growth that you have to overcome. You chose one of seven called self-destruction. There are seven primary body types. You have a jovial body type with a secondary of lunar and so forth. So there, on my Michael charts, there's about 20 pieces of information about how you, as a soul, decided that you were going to experience planet Earth and this lifetime. I've done over 10,000 of these Michael charts over the last 32 years for people all over the world. And people who study this information often get very excited about it because it's just so fascinating. And often they'll order charts on all their friends and family so that they can better understand them as well.
Can we go through the different roles? Because there's server, priest, artisan, sage, warrior, king, and scholar. What does each one mean?
You'll notice above those on your chart, perhaps you can post your Michael chart on your website so people can follow along with us. Would that be possible?
Yes, definitely. I can do that.
And they can also go to my website, which is called shepherdhoodwin.com. That's shepherdhoodwin. And on my website, there's also a sample Michael chart and a full explanation of that sample Michael chart for people who want more information. There's a glossary. There's a lot of material there. You'll notice that the chart is divided into four columns, or we call these the four axes: inspiration, expression, action, and assimilation. And these simply mean that in the first column, inspiration, all of those traits that are underneath the inspiration axis have to do with the inner world. Expression brings what is in the inner world out into the outer world, so it's communication and creativity. Action has to do purely with the outer world. So we have a movement from internal, moving from in out, and the outer world. And then you have the assimilation axis, which is like the Akashic plane in that it provides a resource for all the other axes. The first three are divided into ordinal and cardinal. Ordinal is contracted and cardinal is expanded. So on the inspiration axis, we have two roles or soul types, server and priest. They are both inspirational roles. And so servers and priests are inspirational people. Servers are ordinal, and so they're contracted, meaning that they like to inspire in the down-to-earth, tangible, nitty-gritty form of things. And so servers are people who feel a natural affinity for taking care of other people. They're the nurses who feel really good about nursing you when you're ill, or making chicken soup for you, or being a mother and taking care of all the children. They love to caretake in down-to-earth ways. There are people who wait on you at the post office or in the restaurants or whatever. They like caring for other people in practical ways. Priests are inspirational in a cardinal or big picture or exalted way. So priests want to heal you. They want to help you find your path in life. They want to counsel you. You find a lot of doctors and other healers who are priests, and you find a lot of nurses who are servers. And so it's a complementary combination. Doctors are attracted to healing you in the big ways. And that's why a lot of doctors are priests. Also, a lot of doctors are scholars, because nowadays doctors need to learn a lot of knowledge, and scholars love knowledge, love collecting it. And so often you will find doctors who have a combination of priest and scholar energies. So not only do you have your own role, but you have secondary influences from other places on the Michael chart. And so you could be a priest with a scholar secondary, or a scholar with a priest secondary, and that might attract you to medicine. It might attract you to all the healing arts, psychotherapists. Priests make excellent therapists, massage therapists of all kinds, because they want to inspire you to your highest good. Whereas servers want to take care of the common good. Servers want to make sure that everyone's day-to-day needs are handled. Priests want your spiritual needs to be handled. You will notice in servers and priests a lot of warmth in their demeanor, because it is inspiration. It's about the inner fire. They want to help. Servers' eyes tend to have a warm, doe-like quality to them, a sweetness, a sincerity, a gentleness. Priests' eyes tend to be hot, penetrating, with even a zeal to them, an intensity. So priests have more intensity because they are cardinal. So those are the two inspiration axis roles or soul types. Artisan and sage are the two expression roles, and these are souls who specialize in self-expression and creativity. Artisans are ordinal, and so they like expressing themselves into form. They are the designers, the creators, the plumbers, the electricians, the architects, and you'll find them in all of the arts also. They are expert in seeing and experiencing structure and creating new structure, correcting structure, for example, fixing things, that sort of thing. Sages are the opposite. They like to create through ideas, because they are cardinal. They're big picture people. And so sages are communicators. They work with ideas. You and I are both sage souls. And so we both like to write, like to teach, like to express ourselves through ideas. The two action roles are warrior and king. Warriors are the ordinal action role, so they like to roll up their sleeves and get a lot of work done. They're simple, no-nonsense people. You find a lot of them in the military and law enforcement, and especially in the business world, where they like to meet challenges. They like excitement. They like adventure. They like going off to war. They like challenging themselves athletically. They like to be strong. King is the cardinal action role, and they're like warriors, except they like to organize other people to action. And so they are leadership types of souls. If you look in a warrior's eyes, you will see a blunt, don't mess with me kind of look. If you look in a king's eyes, you'll have that, but it's a sharper kind of like a knife-like look to them. Sages often have mirth in their eyes. We sages tend to be humorous. The majority of comedians and comic actors are sages or have a strong sage influence to them. The reason for that is that sages seek insight. And one of the ways of finding enlightenment intellectually is to lighten up. And so laughter, jokes, cleverness are a sage specialty, as are knowledge, insight, and wisdom. And so you'll see in a sage's eyes a twinkle, a sparkle, a fun-loving quality, an expressiveness. You'll see their faces be very expressive, rubbery, expressive looks, like Jim Carrey would be an extreme example of that. Artisans have a sweet, radiant, adorable, moody look in their eyes. They can be in five places at once mentally, and so there may be a feeling that they're not all there. So now we go to the last of the seven roles, which is scholar, and scholar is the neutral role because they're on the assimilation axis. They are neither ordinal nor cardinal. They are neutral, and they can insert themselves in any walk of life and do just about anything you could think of, but they do it more as an observer than a participant. They love to study. They love to read. They love to learn. You'll often find them seeking advanced degrees. And scholars are often the hardest role to guess because whatever their secondary influences are, they may take on those secondary flavors as if they were that role. So, for example, a scholar with a discarnate sage essence twin and sage casting, which I can explain later if you wish, may look like a sage, except you get the feeling that it's a little watered down because it goes through that scholar neutrality. Now, each of these seven roles and many of the traits on the Michael chart have a positive and negative pole. And the goal is to be more in your positive pole where unconditional love can get through and less in your negative pole where your actions are distorted by fear. And so if you see a negative pole warrior being coercive, you may think, well, warriors are bad. No, it's just in the negative pole. In the positive pole, persuasion, they're really great at bringing society together and making things work, making societal structures function so that we can all get along with each other. And we learn by studying the Michael teachings is that there is no trait that doesn't have a positive use for it. And we just need to learn how to stay more in the positive and less in the negative poles.
And in my chart, the essence twin is artisan.
Yes, and so you have a secondary trait of the role of artisan, which means that your secondary trait reinforces the expression axis quality of the sage. And so you have secondary traits of artisan. So you would also be good with craft, with structure and form. So you're able to do the full gamut of self-expression from the most conceptual on the sage side to the most practical on the artisan side. I was reading your bio online after I channeled your chart, and you talked about some of the things that interest you as hobbies, like being a musician. Music is the domain of the sage, but also a lot of artisans do music because they love learning how to do things like the fingerings and that sort of thing. Writing science fiction is very much a sage thing, and short stories, although you also have a lot of scholars who are interested in science fiction. You have what we call scholar casting, so you have a scholar flavor to your sage and artisan energies. It means you really like to learn, you probably collect books, that sort of thing.
And so then moving further down the chart, what is a cadre entity?
This is the numbering that Michael Through Me gives to your soul family. So you're in the second soul family out of your group of seven soul families, which is called a cadre, and your cadre number is four. So if someone says, Simon, what entity are you in? You would say, I am in 4-2. And I am in 3-2. So you're just one over from me. We probably have known each other in other lifetimes, which might be part of the reason you contacted me for this interview. I know I have a lot of friends who are in your soul family. Your soul family has a personality to it. So, for example, your soul family is characterized by intellectual brilliance, being sharp-eyed, nothing gets past you, sometimes can be harsh, a bit like the skeptic attitude. And your whole cadre, which is, again, cadre four, is characterized by having exacting specific high standards, bring things into clear focus, and helps manifest their full potential. And so your whole group of soul families has this intellectual, sharp, discriminating, skeptical quality about it. Some well-known people who have been channeled as being in your entity include Humphrey Bogart, Jeff Bridges, Bill Clinton, Miles Davis, Richard Dawkins, Carrie Fisher, Scarlett Johansson, Carl Jung, Garrison Keillor, Daniel Radcliffe, who played Harry Potter, the author Tom Robbins, the Broadway composer Richard Rodgers, Ginger Rogers, Melania Trump, and Anthony William, who is the medical medium. So these are maybe not 100% correct, but it does give you an idea of the flavor of your soul family and the sorts of things that you are working on, not only in this lifetime, but in all your lifetimes on planet Earth.
Further down the chart, there's male, female energy.
Yes, every soul has a particular ratio of male to female energy, and it can be anywhere from 0 to 100 on each side. But most souls are in the middle range of 40 to 60 like you. You have 41% male and 59% female energy. And that means that you're probably equally comfortable in the male and female body, which is generally true of sages anyway. This does not refer to masculine or feminine traits. Specifically, it refers to how goal-oriented you are as a soul. Souls who are very high in male energy tend to be workaholics. They tend to work toward one goal at a time until it is completed. People that are high in female energy tend to be putterers. They tend to do a little of this and a little of that. If you think of the traditional male-female role models where the male would, in a linear way, leave the house, go to work 8 hours, and take the same way home at night, that's a kind of a linear, focused, goal-oriented sort of thing. And his one job was to bring home the bacon or, you know, feed the family and just, you know, do the work. And then the stereotypical woman was more about the inner world, about creating the home. And she was doing a lot of different things. She wasn't working toward one goal. She was picking up the dry cleaning, doing the grocery shopping, taking care of the kids, doing a lot of things. So not as focused on a particular goal. Now, you can be a man with higher female energy, as you are, although you're in that middle range, and so you're comfortable with both. But you can also be a female with higher male energy. And in fact, today, we have a lot of women who have higher male energy, where they have been male more often. And in this era, a lot of souls are taking advantage of the changes in society to get more balanced and saying, okay, well, I've been male so many lifetimes, now it's time for me to have some lessons in the female body and vice versa. So you have a lot of high female energy souls coming into male bodies at this time. Part of the side effect of this is that it's helping women achieve equal rights because you're getting a lot of higher male energy souls into female bodies who are used to having equal rights or more rights because they were men, and now in the female body, they're not putting up with inequality. You will be most attracted to partners who have the opposite of your ratio. So if you're heterosexual, you'll be attracted to women who have 59% male, 41% female energy. But in fact, anyone in the middle range is going to work for you pretty well in that regard. There's just a magnetic quality to the exact opposite.
Okay, and next is frequency.
You're also in the middle range there with a frequency of 46. Each of the roles have a frequency. So we have the two high-frequency roles, which are priest and artisan, who tend to be up in the sky. They're visionary people. They're not so down to earth, like kings, warriors, and scholars, which are the low-frequency roles. Sages and servers have a middle frequency. You also can have an individual frequency anywhere from 1 to 100. And again, most people are in the middle in that regard. Someone with a very high frequency, even if they're not a high frequency role, such as priest or artisan, will feel less of this world. They feel dreamy. They go through their experiences very quickly because they vibrate so quickly. Maybe they burn out more quickly also. Souls with a low frequency have a more slow and steady experience of the physical plane. And this remains the same in every Earth lifetime because it's in the top half of the chart.
And when it says previous cycles, does that mean that I've been through the cycle of infant, baby, young, mature, and old before?
Yes, 10 other planets, 10 other life forms. The average person on Earth has had 4 previous grand cycles. So at 10, you have about 2.5 times the average, although 10 is a very typical number to come up in the charts that I channel. If you'd only had 4 previous grand cycles, we probably would not be on the phone right now discussing the Michael teachings because you would be having a more simple experience of planet Earth. The highest number we know anyone on Earth has had is 19. For example, the man who was Jesus before the infinite soul incarnated into his body had 19 previous grand cycles. So for an Earthling, he was very complex. On other planets closer to the center of the universe, the average number of previous grand cycles would be much higher, and they have a much more complex society. Mind you, complex is not better than simple. It's just different.
So that is everything that's in the essence section, which I think you said that was basically your soul character?
Yes.
The overleave section is more this lifetime's character.
Correct.
So can we go through that with goal, attitude, mode, center, chief obstacle, and body types? Do we choose all these things?
Everything is chosen. Everything on this chart, some part of you chose. All the basic foundational aspects of your life are things that you chose. Now, other people have free will, and they can affect your choices, but you chose everything on this chart.
So where it says skeptic in attitude?
Right. So these are your overleaves. Your goal is what you want to experience in each lifetime. And with your goal of dominance, you want to experience leadership in this lifetime. Leadership is the positive pole of the goal of dominance, and dictatorship is the negative pole. When you're in the negative pole, you're being bossy to other people. But when you're in the positive pole, you are creating win-win solutions for all concerned.
Okay.
Now, the most common of the 7 goals is called growth. That 40% of us are in growth and tend to be quite busy people. They fill all their spare time with projects. That's how you can tell someone in growth. 30% of us have a goal of acceptance. That's my goal. And acceptance is all about learning to say yes, to be a nice guy, to help people get along, to mediate. Your goal of dominance, as I mentioned, is about leadership. It's not as common a goal as some of the others. The attitude, then, is how we look at the world. And you look at the world through the eyes of a skeptic, and that means that you question things. Skeptics make excellent interviewers, because the skeptic attitude is all about asking questions. And of course, that's what you're doing in this interview and in all your interviews. Skeptics also make excellent scientists, journalists, etc. And so with the attitude of skeptic, you just want to investigate things. You start out from the premise that this may not be true. I need to gather information. And you do gather the information. And in the positive poll, if you're convinced, then you're satisfied and you're okay with it. The negative poll is you never stop investigating because you're suspicious. You just can't believe that something is what it says it is. And so being suspicious would be a pitfall for you to watch out for.
And then mode is caution.
Yes, so the most popular of the seven modes, the mode is the way that you run your energy, the way you operate. The most popular by far is observation mode. Half of us are in observation. And I'm in observation. So I spend a lot of time just observing, looking. I look neutral to other people. If I'm in a big new city, I'm staring all the time because I like to observe. The second most common mode is caution, which is what you are in. And that means that you run your energy, you lead and you investigate through being careful. You're a careful, deliberate person. You want to put on the brakes a little bit and make careful, deliberate choices in all things. The negative pole of that is phobia, where instead of just being careful, you're frozen into inaction. You don't want to do anything.
And then the center is physical.
But you do have, do you find that you are a careful person, a deliberate person?
Yes, yes, definitely.
So you have learned to be more in your positive pole of your caution mode, which is a good thing because the negative pole phobia can be very debilitating. And if you've had many lifetimes in caution mode, you've probably learned how to handle it well.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. So the center is the part that you react from. You are physically centered, which some channels have called the sexual center. You react to things through the excitation of your body. So you have gut feelings, you have hot flashes. You experience life predominantly through your body's sensations. And when you are being present with your body's sensations, then your emotions will take form based on your body's experience. So we call this the emotional part of the physical center. As a sage, you tend to be very intellectual, but in this lifetime, you are not as intellectual as you would be if you had an intellectual center. So clearly your soul said, okay, Simon, in this lifetime, we're going to learn how to be in our body more and in our head less, and we're going to experience the sensations of our body. We're going to put more focus on our sexual experiences and feeling things and let our emotions flow from the body. And you may have chosen this because you had a lot of lifetimes where you were too intellectual, too much in your head.
I see. Too much of a smart ass.
Well, we sages like being smart asses. So, so being physically centered is you're learning about your body in this lifetime.
It's not something I've ever really thought about before. So with the chief obstacle, is that we choose to put an obstacle in our own path?
Well, it's more that on the physical plane, we're all going to occasionally be self-deprecating or arrogant or greedy or impatient or stubborn or whatever. These are all traits of being human. And when your soul, this is usually solidified around the age of 18. So it can be changeable during childhood and the teen years, but around the age of 18, when you leave your parents' home, your soul tends to settle on one of them that is the thing that's most important for you to work on for the next several years at least. And yours is called self-destruction.
So, but that can have positives and negatives.
Well, we learn a lot by overcoming our obstacle. The obstacle is always a negative because it's fear-based. Self-destruction is defined as a fear of loss of control. And with self-destruction, it often comes from a childhood where there wasn't enough safety and structure from the parents. So you grew up feeling like you had to create your own sense of safety. And so there could be an excessive amount of self-discipline, and that could swing to the opposite of losing all self-control. In the most negative versions of this, one could be a drug addict or an alcoholic or whatever, because it's swinging from the extreme of too much self-control and not enough. And so there can be a sense of insecurity when things are not orderly, when things are not under control, and an attempt to impose that. And so the lesson for someone in self-destruction is to orient toward the safety of the universe, to feel like, you know, all is really well, even if at the moment I don't believe that it is, even if I'm feeling shaky and I don't have a solid, safe foundation under me, I am learning to feel the safety of being an eternal divine soul held safely in the hand of God, you might say.
And then there's body types, and you say that I'm jovial, but you don't, that doesn't mean funny, does it? It means Joven, like Jupiter?
Yes. Yes, it has the astrological influence of jovial. And your secondary body type is lunar. Jovial, lunar are both passive body types. Body types, we could spend a whole hour just talking about the body types. It's fascinating and it's very useful. And it has a lot to do with the personality of our physical body rather than the personality of our soul. So our body has a personality apart from the soul. And body types each have three traits. They're either masculine or feminine. They're either positive or negative, which is like an electrical charge. And they're either active or passive. And both jovial and lunar are passive body types. If you have an active, 100% active body type, you can hardly sit still. The jovial lunar body type might have to work a little extra hard to get into gear, to get to go, you know, like a go exercise. It may not come as naturally to the person with 100% passive body type. There are pros and cons to each configuration. For example, for you to sit still long enough to do all this writing, having a passive body type is very useful. I also have a highly passive body type. But the negative of that is that you can put on weight easily because there isn't that antsiness, that fidgetiness that the active body types have that make them want to move all the time. Body types each have an attraction. So jovial is attracted to mercurial, and lunar is attracted to Saturnian. So you would be attracted to people who have a mercurial Saturnian body type, or at least one of those two traits. And when you have body type attraction, your body forms an electrical circuit with the other person. And it's great in a sexual relationship. It gives you a head up in terms of having good sex with that person. But it's also good with friends because your body just feels energized by being with someone who has the opposite body type. So this is a really great thing to study and to learn about.
And then finally at the bottom is soul age, which you gave us a great description of all the different soul ages earlier. And apparently I'm young 5.
Yes, and so what we find is that young souls may start taking an interest in things like spirituality and past lives and that sort of thing if it's not part of their dominant culture. Around the middle of the soul age, they start getting more curious about what's out there. And young souls tend to have a lot of vitality. So assuming that you don't have any major health problems that would sap your vitality, young souls have the energy of youth where they can work really hard and accomplish a lot and get a lot done. And then the fifth level of the young cycle is a time of innovation. Five is the sage number. And sages are all about expansion and adventure and innovation and trying new things. And so it's a really exciting time. When the United States had an average soul age of fifth level young, that's when most of the world's innovation was coming out of the United States. Now, the United States average is sixth level young. And at sixth level young, six is a priest level, and it's about karmic payback. And so the United States is less innovative today, and we're dealing with a lot of national karmic payback. So fifth level young is it's the sage level, and you are already a sage. And so it's a lot of exciting discovery at the soul age.
Great. Well, thank you for going through the chart and describing everything. It was fascinating stuff. Could you tell us about the books that you have out?
My book about the Michael teachings is called Journey of Your Soul, A Channel Explores the Michael Teachings. And it goes through this chart and Michael's cosmology in great detail. On my website, you can find all of my books, and you can also find a page for other Michael books that might be of interest to you. I have four books that are collections of Michael channeling that are not about the Michael chart information, but they're just more general spiritual instruction. You might compare them to Jane Roberts Seth books in that they're more experiential and they're less intellectual. These are called Loving from Your Soul, Growing Through Joy, Opening to Healing, and Being in the World. Loving from Your Soul did have a print edition and can be found used. It's not currently available in print. All of my books are available as Kindle books. And within the next year or two, I plan to revise all the books and then make them available as print-on-demand editions as well. If you go to my website, you can see the other books that I have. I do have a print edition available of my book, Meditations for Self-Discovery, which is a collection of 45 guided meditations that if you're a workshop or group leader of any kind, you might enjoy doing with your group, or you could just do them on your own and then interpret them like dreams. I also have a humor book called Enlightenment for Nitwits, which is available both in print and in electronic versions, and it's kind of a spoof of New Age stuff. You might enjoy that, being a sage. I can email you a PDF of that, Simon, if you'd like to take a look at it.
Yeah, that would be brilliant. Could you give us your website address again?
ShepherdHoodwin.com. ShepherdHoodwin.com.
Well, thank you very much for being a guest on the podcast. It's been a really great conversation.
It's been a pleasure, Simon. I'd also like to mention that I will be doing a series of workshops in Europe in 2019. And if you go to my events page, you can see the tentative schedule for next year. So far, we have workshops planned for Munich, Moscow, and Zurich for the first level of the chart study. And then for people who have already attended a workshop, we have some level twos planned. And then we're also doing a healing workshop in Venice for a week where you can come. And I'll be working with Andre Hinterman. We'll be doing a combination of various healing modalities. We may even do some past life regression, but we will be mainly working with family constellations and trauma healing. And we will use your Michael chart as a way to understand some of what of the work that you're doing. So all of that's available. And if you go to any page on my website, you can sign up for my Perspectives newsletter, which goes out about once a season and will give you information about what I'm doing and will contain a free channeling or article.
And if somebody wants to have their Michael chart done for them, they just contact you through the website?
Absolutely, yes. There's an order form. And the order form will take you through the steps. You will simply provide your full name, your birth information, whatever you have, provide a clear photo showing your eyes. If you've already had any of this type of information channeled, you will list that and mention if you agree or disagree. And you'll simply then order it on my form, and you'll get the chart back from me within 6 weeks.
Fantastic. Okay, thanks again, Shepherd. It's been a great conversation.
My pleasure. Take care.
And that was an interview with Shepherd Hoodwin, where we talked about channeling the Michael teachings. A great way to support the podcast is to sign up on Patreon. For $6 a month, you get an extended episode every week. And for $3 a month, you get an extended episode every month. These exclusive Patreon episodes are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. You can become a patron by going to patreon.com/Our Paranormal Afterlife. And there is an Our Paranormal Afterlife Facebook group, and if you'd like to join, you'd be very welcome. And if you enjoy the podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.